Hello and welcome to Gascast. In this numbers, data and stats episode, we'll be looking at how a British anaesthetist has used maths to blow wide open yet another anaesthetic research scandal. Mark is going to use some complex statistics to prove that expensive helicopters really do save lives. Frank is going to look at the impact of preoperative anemia, and Bex is going to reassure us that in the grandest of grand schemes, our anaesthetic practice really does influence long-term outcomes. All this, plus the usual remaining 34.3% in the form of our discoveries, biology of bunkum, and Mark's question of the month. I'm Rick Thomas, and back with me are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hi, everyone.
So, let's crack on with our discoveries for this month. So, Frank, glad to see you made it back from your extended holiday in South America.
You say holiday, I say academic leave. But my discovery was actually going to be in part a question to Mark, because having had the pleasure of doing on-call weekend, I see we now have a HEMS straight to CT protocol stuck up on the wall of A&E.
Yeah.
And that was news to me. Obviously, I haven't read the anaesthetic department handbook closely enough. And I had a quick look through it, but I was wondering if you could tell us which patients qualify for that and if you've had any experience in doing it and how successful it's been.
Yeah, I've got a lot of experience. I did the first case, in fact. At the moment, it's any adult trauma patients, and St. George's are working on an opt-out policy. So if it's an adult trauma patient being brought in by HEMS, they will assume it's going to go direct to CT. Of course, HEMS team leader or the A&E team leader can bottle out of that at any point for pretty much any reason if a patient's too unstable. I think being a code red patient is an automatic opt-out because they may need to get some blood products on the way. And the idea is you give an advance warning call, you'll meet the trauma team leader and nurse in the ambulance bay as normal, and proceed straight through recess into CT, do the handover there, and then have the patient back into recess or directly to theatre within kind of 10-15 minutes of getting through the door. Experience so far has been pretty good, considering, as you'd imagine, with a large hospital infrastructure. There's a few teething problems with getting the right bleeps out and the right people in the right places, but generally it's been very good. And most of the other trauma centres are now following suit with similar policies.
And what, as an example, what was the sort of last case that you treated under that protocol?
So the patients I've taken in have largely been isolated head injuries, who've been very stable during transfer and haven't had anything else that's concerned me or that's needed immediate intervention prior to CT.
Yeah, I suppose it makes good sense, and I'm glad to hear that it is working as it's meant to be. And I'm certainly better informed now and will be better prepared should you darken our threshold any time in the near future.
I'll do my best.
To darken Frank's threshold.
The collective George's threshold.
Right, I don't know if that makes it any better. Okay, so moving swiftly around, Bex, been some time since we've heard from you, so how have you been the last month?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm about to blow you out of the water with my discovery. You'll be so pleased to know, Rick, that it's not an app, but it is a syndrome, a very, very rare syndrome, which, unless you're working in a quaternary referral centre, you're unlikely to come across, but I still found it fascinating nonetheless. We have got a patient with something called Klippel-Trenaunay-Weber syndrome, and it is a very rare syndrome which is characterized by a triad of port wine stains, varicose veins, and bony and soft tissue hypertrophy, which involves just a single extremity. Now, it's incredibly rare. There's no real cause. It's not known why exactly it happens. It's a spontaneous abnormality that people can get. It affects pretty much all races and all sexes equally. And it's important because these patients that can have this isolated single limb gigantism will also have associated varicose veins and arteriovenous malformations. So if you ever do come across one of these, you should be aware that they may have cerebral arteriovenous malformations, which would be important with things like laryngoscopy. Or if you're going to do an epidural, for example, they may have all sorts of abnormal venous plexuses in their back, which if you didn't know that they were associated with the syndrome, you could accidentally skewer with your TUI needle. And that is how I came across it. Not on the skewering.
I was going to say, tell me you didn't find one at the end of your epidural needle.
No, not at the end, but luckily with a bit of research before I proceeded with my epidural, I found out they can have them, and perhaps my epidural wasn't such a good idea.
But hang on, the cardinal feature of this syndrome is one ginormous limb.
It's just an isolated limb that's absolutely monstrous. I mean, it's massive. It's sort of, like two or three of the other limbs put together.
That is absolutely fascinating.
It is.
We used to have one at medical school. They used to roll out for the exams. Had a humongous left arm.
Oh, is it massively strong? Was it massively strong as well?
No, it's hugely overdeveloped.
It's just enormous, yeah.
Yeah, it's hugely overdeveloped, but it's also just swollen. But I mean, they do get... everything's bigger, isn't it? Well, at least this guy was. Because they get bigger bone growth and muscle growth and everything. But it's also swollen.
It's just a single limb is just enormous. Yeah. It's just like on a magnified scale.
I'm sure there is a superhero in...
Yeah, no, it is. Isn't Hellboy? Doesn't Hellboy have like a big...
You're right, it's Hellboy, yeah. He's got a massive arm.
That'd be a much better name for the syndrome.
Hellboy syndrome. Okay, so Mark, what have you discovered this month?
Well, I am going to tell you about a smartphone or tablet.
There's always to be one.
There's always one who ruins it for Rick.
I was so excited about this, I tweeted it out on the Gascast Twitter feed a few weeks ago. It's an app called SimMoon, and this is really useful for anybody who's doing simulation training, of any kind of simulation training, really, especially outdoors or survival situations or places where you're not in a high-tech simulation suite. And this app runs on two devices, so normally you would use your smartphone as a controller and your tablet device to display a simulation of a patient monitor, and therefore you can change the parameters displayed on the phone and they'll be reflected on the tablet, so you can place that by your patient. And it, having now used it in action last week, it really did add an extra layer of realism, having the kind of subtle visual and audio cues that you have in real life, and the changing tone of the saturations slowly going down definitely got people's attention. So called SimMoon, available through your normal app buying outlets. Give it a look.
Very cool. So I'm glad you mentioned Twitter, because that'll be our first Twitter mention for the podcast. And one of my discoveries was that if you get retweeted by Atul Gawande, it crashes your server. I don't know if for anyone who's been following our Twitter feed, I thought I'd try for a slightly hopeful retweet and tweeted at Atul Gawande to mention the podcast, because we featured Lifebox on it. And he's, of course, one of the people who's involved in that. And lo and behold, a few hours later, he did retweet us, and immediately a decent proportion of his 32,000 followers tried to log on to the Gascast site, which is hosted on a tiny little server that is down a domestic phone line, and it immediately exploded. And then we got loads of angry retweets about why people couldn't get to the podcast. So I'm really sorry about that, but you have to think carefully before you ask for retweets from these people. So that was one of my discoveries.
It's also well worth it, though.
Well, I think it probably just served to make people angrier and think we were even worse organised than we in fact are. I've got two other quick discoveries as well. Gas Class, which I mentioned on the last podcast, was just wrapping up their end of term, but they are going to be restarting again this week or next week, I think. So by the time this episode's out, they should be in full flow, so remember to check them out, gasclass.wordpress.org, I think, or just Google Gasclass, or search for the hashtag Gasclass on Twitter. And my final very quick discovery was a win for the podcast notes, a win for WordPress, and a win for the internet. I don't know if you remember, but quite a few episodes ago, I mentioned a discovery about giving intravesical lignocaine for catheter irritation. I haven't actually done that for several months now, but I had it happen to me the other night when I was on ITU. I couldn't for the life of me remember the dose. But for those people who actually go through to the podcast notes and check out how we index them, pretty much everything we mention in the podcast, we do try and make sure we have a quick link through to where it is on the internet. And the search function in WordPress is surprisingly good. So I was actually able to log onto our own site, just put in lignocaine and search terms. It came up with the correct thing, linked through to PubMed, and gave me the dose I required.
Brilliant. So,
yeah.
How much is it? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Come on, Rick, don't crack under pressure.
I think it was 2 milligrams per kilogram.
So just less than the toxic dose.
It's just less than the toxic dose. But when you're not used to giving it, you do want to check. And actually, the podcast notes were at least useful to one person. So for our news and journals this month, we are quite numbers, data, and stats heavy, as I mentioned. But I'll kick us off, and I'm going to be reporting on a news story that has been brewing for a while, but has quite literally blown up this month in... Sorry.
It's not Michael Jackson again, is it?
No, this is much better.
Whitney Houston?
No, much better.
Hang on. This is the kind of thing Rick gets excited about.
Yeah. What do you mean, is it? Did you read the stuff I sent through?
I did, yeah.
No, not you, Rebecca.
Give me a headache did Bex?
Yeah, because you just asked me what I'm going to be talking about. This is the bit that shouldn't be a surprise.
Oh, carry on.
You're going to have to ask her some pointed questions.
Right. And that story is Yoshitaka Fuji. It's a cracking tale of personalities, maths, and questionable motive that unfolds in May's edition of Anesthesia in a truly shocking but fascinating narrative that I will try my best to relate. There's no way I can do it justice in under 10 minutes, so I do urge you to go and read the story for yourself. Anesthesia research has recently been rocked by revelations of research fraud committed by Joachim Bolt and Scott Rubens, and the subsequent retractions that this has necessitated. In 2010, Anesthesia published an editorial relating to the impact of fabricated or poor quality research on scientific datasets, particularly with regard to meta-analyses, the ones we all love to quote and in large part rely on. In that article, a demonstration was made looking at the efficiency of Granisetron and how the overall effect has been skewed by multiple small studies coming from one single centre, and how that compared with less convincing results from far larger trials. And that was, in fact, Fuji's data, which had previously had the finger of suspicion pointed at it in 2000 in a Scandinavian anaesthetic journal, but it appears there wasn't extensive follow-up to that comment. Enter Dr. John Carlyle, the hero of our tale. So, in response to the 2010 editorial, Dr. Carlyle wrote a letter into Anesthesia, basically agreeing and pointing out the evidence base for Granisetron remained distorted due to this suspect data, and challenging the journal editors to do something about it. It's probably worth mentioning that Dr. Carlyle's previous work happened to include the 2006 Cochrane Review of Drugs Preventing Nausea and Vomiting After Surgery. And in response to his letter, John Carlyle receives a counter-challenge from Steve Yentis to mathematically prove his point, something that is extremely intimidating, but a challenge he accepts nonetheless. So John Carlyle's article in this month's Anesthesia, The Analysis of 168 Randomized Controlled Trials to Test Data Integrity, is a phenomenal piece of work. I'm always astounded at the amount of time and level of detail that I imagine must go into Cochrane analyses, and having already completed one and clearly not afraid of spreadsheets or PubMed, Dr. Carlyle was clearly the right man for the job. However, assessing, weighting, and amalgamating data from several RCTs in an attempt to answer a clinical question has got to be a far simpler task than trawling through individual components of an RCT to look for statistical evidence of research fraud. In both Dr. Carlyle's article and Professor Pandit's editorial, they attempt to explain the methodology behind their maths, and whilst it is quite complicated, after careful reading it does, I think, make sense. Again, I urge you to read it for yourself, but for those frightened by numbers and probabilities, the statistics put into the review in themselves are both thorough and very convincing. 19 months worth of work, 18 reiterations, and a consultation with 3 statisticians. So to quickly go through what the article actually says, Dr. Fuji's first mistake was his prolific publication rate. It's comparatively easier to get away with one murder than it is several serial murders. The more bodies you produce, the more evidence you leave. In 20 years, Dr. Fuji has published 168 randomized controlled trials, averaging over 600 patients per year, which is extremely impressive for one department, let alone one man. This vast body of work leaves a wealth of data to analyze, and as I understand it, in very basic terms, Dr. Carlisle's analysis centered around looking at the variability of data within the sets quoted in Dr. Fuji's work. When conducting research, you're always forced to examine a sample population, because examining the total population you're interested in is probably going to be impossible. In prospective research, you hope that by randomly allocating your sample population to different groups, you'll account for the variables, both recognized and unrecognized, that would affect the validity of your result. When you measure something in your sample population and take the mean value, you would like to know how close this value approximates to the total population you would have liked to have sampled if you had unlimited resources, both in terms of time and finance. You calculate this by the knowledge of 2 other values, the standard deviation, which gives you the spread of the data, and the number in your sample group. These values can be used to give you the 95% confidence interval, which is the range within which you have 95% confidence that the true mean of your entire population lies, and the standard error of the mean, which is an estimate of the amount that an obtained mean may be expected to differ by chance from a true mean. What I think forms the crux of Dr. Carlisle's work is that when you randomly allocate subjects to a sample group, the reported distributions will differ, based on sample size, but will inevitably, given enough data, adhere to a normal distribution for continuous or binomial distribution for binary or categorical data. And the absolute genius behind Carlisle's analysis is that he doesn't examine the result that was the question of Fuji's work, but rather the chance that the variables reported within the groups, particularly the control groups, could have occurred by chance. Fortunately, because of Fuji's massive back catalogue, there definitely is enough data. The problem stems from the fact that humans are incredibly bad at generating random data. We simply don't have the imagination for it, especially when we actively try. The maths can't lie, and in the article, Dr. Carlisle convincingly demonstrates that the chance of Dr. Fuji collecting the data he claims to have done so by chance is incredibly low. In one instance, he calculates it at 1 in a decillion, or the probability of picking one specific atom from all the human bodies on the Earth. One of the easiest and sloppiest examples is detailed early on in the discussion, where in 5 independent groups, Fuji has observed the identical mean day since last menstrual period and exactly the same standard deviation in 5 independent groups, with a sample size of only 20 per group. Just that alone seems strange. To add more weight to the already very convincing argument, Carlisle goes on to use the same statistical techniques to analyse 366 other RCTs by other authors and demonstrates that they do indeed adhere to the expected normal distributions. There is no doubt that this is an utterly stunning piece of academic work in its own right, and nothing short of sensational given the context. I'll admit to be a little inappropriately turned on by the maths, but I love the fact that where Fuji has been caught is not, as you would expect, in the fabrication of his experimental data to produce wholly unbelievable results, but in his human failing to inadequately fabricate a normally distributed random sample. This debacle raises a number of issues, including one I'm very enthusiastic about, namely the publishing of original datasets. I have some very limited experience trying to perform sample size calculations to adequately power a study. To do this, you need some form of experimental data on which to base your prospective sample, and this quite often comes from other people's published work. However, you only ever have access to their mean and standard deviation data, which you sometimes have to extrapolate from graphs and figures, and is very often wrong, i.e. it becomes apparent they've used the standard error of the mean when they should have used the standard deviation and vice versa. With virtually unlimited storage and the comparative minuscule size of a spreadsheet, I see no reason why journals can't insist authors hand over their original dataset and then shove the whole lot in some form of online repository. It makes a process that should be entirely transparent, more transparent, aids other people doing similar research and may provide others with the opportunity to perform analyses that the original authors hadn't thought of. As if the story couldn't get any better, Fuji actually responds with a letter in the same issue of Anesthesia. In it, he claims that the observed discrepancies are down to possible poor data collection and the lack of variability amongst the Japanese population. He does not offer to give Dr. Carlyle his original data set for further analysis. In a twist reminiscent of Al Capone getting done for tax fraud, Dr. Fuji was in fact dismissed from Toho University in February this year for failing to gain ethical approval for 8 papers. It is probably best to end this discussion with a reply to Dr. Fuji's letter by John Carlyle, Steve Yentis, and Professor Pandit. We thank Dr. Fuji for his letter, which, unfortunately, does not address the fundamental basis of the analysis of his work. As has been explained, the distribution of means sampled from any population of continuous measurements, no matter how bizarre the original distribution of measurements, is always normal or Gaussian. Furthermore, the alleles that contribute to individual characteristics behave according to fundamental laws of nature and thus apply to all populations, including the Japanese, however distinct they may be. The statistical principles underlying the analysis are literally universal. Apart from genetics, they apply to the behavior of tiny particles, e.g. mass velocity of atoms, and galaxies, e.g. Doppler shifts, and to analysis of the extremes of time, e.g. the speed of light and the slowest radioactive decay. An exception to these mathematical principles would shake the basis of most of modern scientific knowledge and understanding. Access to Dr. Fuji's original data would help us confirm the veracity or otherwise of his claims. So there you have it. I was, as you can tell, slightly overexcited by the whole thing, but I do suggest you go and look through it all for yourself in the 3 or 4 editorials, 1 article and 2 letters that are in May's issue of Anesthesia.
And for those who don't share Rick's passion and enthusiasm for the mathematics of it, there's some pretty pictures in the article which help explain the minimal likelihood of the data being correct.
Yeah, it is. I don't understand it entirely, but it is very convincing. And it, when you see the graphs and everything, it's so obvious. It is. It's absolutely brilliant, though.
So, from Yentis's editorial, though, because you know where they talk about using Authenticate to cross-reference articles, and make sure that you're not being plagiarizing. You do have to wonder, because there's 2 points that come from what you said. You know, will editors or publishers now start checking data to see if these sorts of errors are coming through? Because Carlyle doesn't say whether you can't really prove, can you, that this is fabricated data or whether they are just errors made, which is kind of difficult to accept for the hundreds of studies that displayed this.
I think Carlyle's proved that the data is unreliable. It's not real, but it doesn't tell you how it was fabricated. Whether it was fabricated by a bad computer program, but more likely it's someone who's just sort of knows what the data should look like. Because I think within itself, it's relatively sensible. The means are all sensible. The standard deviations are all sort of sensible. And when he compares them between groups, he finds there's a sort of group intervariability, which is what you want to look for, apart from in whatever effect it is you're looking for in your experimental group. That all seems sensible, but it's when you tie it all together, you can see that the randomness that should be there just isn't there. And if you look at the amount of work that must have gone into this process of showing, you know, how it's gone wrong, I'd love to have a chat with Dr. Carlyle and get the story behind, you know, how he did it all.
Well, you just need to pin him down at the next conference you go to.
Do a bit of stalking or something. But it wouldn't be practically feasible, I don't think, to do it. Authenticate is an automatic program. I saw Charles Riley at the World Congress demonstrating how it worked. You just shove something in, press a button, go away, come back, and it sort of gives you almost a sentence by sentence review of how many places it could have possibly come from. To do the same thing with data sets has got to be possible, but as far as I'm aware, is not out there. However, forcing people to hand over their original data sets would make that a lot easier, because it's very easy to fabricate a mean and a standard deviation and a sample size. It's very difficult to fabricate a load of numbers which are random and normally distributed but give you the mean and standard deviation you want in a certain sample size. That is a much trickier feat. So the suspicion is that the reason he's not handing over an original data set is because he doesn't have one. Anyway, from that, we should probably move on and move on to some even trickier statistics that Mark has been looking at to do with helicopters.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about a paper that was in this month's Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Association Between Helicopter versus Ground Emergency Medical Services and Survival for Adults with Major Trauma. And this was all put together by a team led by an intensivist and anaesthetist in Maryland, America, called Sam Galvano. What they've essentially done is looked at their National Trauma Data Bank, from which they drew a pool of 1.8 million patients over a three-year period, and they selected out the ones they wanted to look at, which were adults over the age of 15 who were treated at level 1 or 2 trauma centres. These adults all had injury severity scores greater than 15 and were victims of blunt and penetrating trauma, but not special types of trauma like burns or drowning or those kind of things. So they ended up with 223,000 cases, about a third of which had been transported into hospital by helicopter and the remainder by ground. Now this is where the complicated stats kicks in, because the bare numbers show that a greater proportion of the helicopter patients ended up dying, but I guess, like most of us, they thought there might be other reasons for this, like the helicopter was going to more serious cases, for example. And so what they did is they tried to match up the two data sets. Now this is something which I still don't really understand, so maybe you can help us out with this, Rick, but they used propensity score matching, whereby looking at a whole load of variables across the two groups, they could try to match them up, and this is a technique used for often situations where it's an observational study and you haven't got the luxury of being able to randomize and blind two groups. They used multiple logistic regression to do this as well, and ended up, surprise, surprise, finding an association with improved survival for patients transported by helicopter versus ground, with an odds ratio of 1.13 for survival. So, generally, for me, a good paper, because it kind of justifies my day job, but it all hinges on whether or not you believe or trust in these statistical methods. And I, having read this paper over and over again, still feel somewhat blinded by the science and unable to get my head around exactly how these figures add up. Do you know anything about these methods, Rick?
I did, because you mentioned to me that you were reviewing this paper, so I did have a look at it from a statistical perspective. And a couple of things which I think are worth bearing in mind generally when you're looking at any paper like this. The statistics are extremely clever, and they're very well done, and it's in JAMA. It's a good quality review. And as the authors point out at the beginning, I think the question they're trying to answer is, despite the fact that helicopters go to patients who have got higher injury severity scores, they tend to be better equipped in terms of the personnel or the seniority or expertise of the personnel on board. But is it the helicopter itself that saves the life? Is it...
Well, I was going to come back to that.
Yeah, I think that's the purpose of the review, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they're looking at it very, very bluntly, very generally. Do the helicopter patients do better than the road patients? And as you've hinted at there, this is what I ended up thinking at the end of it was, it's all very nice that this paper shows a better survival for helicopter patients, but we don't know whether that's about speed of getting a team to the scene or speed of getting to a trauma center, or, as you mentioned, the skill set on board the helicopter versus land, or the distance away from a trauma center where the incident happened. None of these none of these things we know yet, and what we need to do is try to work out what it is about these helicopter patients being in a helicopter that that improved their survival odds ratio.
Well, I think what the propensity score matching does is attempts to take all of that stuff into account. First thing, which they do also point out, is that you can't do a double-blind, prospective, randomized control trial on this type of thing. It's just it's just not feasible, and it would be a logistical and ethical nightmare. So you're forced to do retrospective analyses and look at what is here a massive data set, 1.8 million, I think you said. So it is huge.
Yeah.
But what propensity score matching, as far as I understand, intends to do is you have to sit around and have a look at causality and have a look at why certain patients will get treated in a certain limb that you're looking at, so either the helicopter limb or whatever, and then weight various factors accordingly. And then when you do your retrospective analysis, you take into account these factors and hope that that enables you to tease out the actual question you want to answer, which in this study, I think, was, is it the helicopter that makes the difference? Their odds ratio is 1.16, and I think most people probably have in their head that an odds ratio of greater than 1 is probably good for whatever your intervention is. The intervention in this case is the helicopter. However, it is a little bit about how you present their data. So an odds ratio of 1.16, they actually do say that you've got an absolute relative risk reduction of 1.5%, which is not very much. But let me express that as numbers needed to treat, which is something I think we, a statistic almost invented for doctors, because it's something we all understand.
They say that they need to treat 65 patients for one extra survival.
And that's a lot of very expensive helicopter rides.
See, that was my issue with the study, because, and what the authors do allude to towards the end, though, is that you do need a formal cost-effectiveness analysis to decide whether or not it's a policy worth pursuing just because of the incredible costs associated with it. I think they quoted something like, what was it, $325,000 spent to save one life because of the numbers needed to treat being 65.
Which is huge. It's absolutely massive. And I thought it was a really interesting paper that you picked, because looking at the face of it, or just reading the abstract, the statistic they telegraph is the odds ratio, and you look, odds ratio is positive, excellent, we'll buy more helicopters. But then actually reading it, it puts a lot of things into question, really, I thought. Helicopters are definitely good, but are they worth the money?
Well, I think that this unfortunately doesn't add any weight to a conversation I have very often, which is that it's my opinion that certainly in our UK system, that the helicopter itself is a big distraction to people, and in terms of what we do, it's, to me, I think, although this study doesn't back me up, it's way more about the skills of the crew and the availability of advanced interventions that we can do. And it just so happens that trauma is infrequent enough that we cover a very large area, and therefore the best way of us getting around is a helicopter. It's, for me, far, far less about transporting the patient anywhere. And indeed, many of the major trauma centres we're using in the UK still don't have their own helicopter landing sites. So I don't think it's... I think the big, noisy mode of transport is a bit of a distraction, and what we really need to establish is how effective is the role of a physician-led pre-hospital team.
But you see, actually, I think this study... I disagree. I think this study does back you up. We could have done exactly the same study, and we could have written the abstract so that it said... Helicopters do improve outcome, but when we account for physician's skill with propensity score matching, the result is in fact negligible, and therefore what we need are more highly skilled, qualified pre-hospital carers getting out to patients in order to get out to patients faster.
I'm pretty sure this paper didn't even collect data on what the crew was. I think this was purely about the method of transport.
Okay, then now we're getting into the stage of who managed to delve through the paper properly. But I thought I thought when I read it that they did have a lot of missing data. That was one. That was another confession they made, that a lot of their data sets were not complete. But I thought they did have a reasonable amount of data, and part of their propensity score matching was to try and exclude the bias caused by having more highly trained people on the helicopters than you would on the ground crews.
Yeah, I suppose they did mention that. They did mention trying to remove clustering from particular areas, particular trauma centres and so on. So I suppose that might be included in that. But I got some extra information. If you go to the JAMA website, you can watch a little video interview with the lead author, and he explains a little bit about what they did and how they did it. And it was his closing comments that helped me to realise that they still don't know what element of the helicopter is really providing this benefit. And also, the paper doesn't mention journey time, so I don't know, you know, whether this is likely to be different in America with longer journey times compared to the UK.
Well, they mentioned in the article that the crew configuration varies a lot from region to region, and sometimes it'll just be a paramedic or a paramedic, exactly, and a nurse and a physician. And I think one of the studies showed that even the presence of a physician didn't actually give a survival benefit, and that usually it was just the beneficial effect was a combination of the sort of skill mix on board, the speed at which they got to hospital, and which trauma center they went to. But as you said, Rick, I think there was quite a lot of data missing, and there's quite a, I mean, I think as much as I understand propensity matching, I think it is a good idea, and I think there's great value with a lot of, well, mostly the states, but a lot of institutions that have these huge databases that you can query. And I think there's a lot of valuable information coming out of querying these databases with even in a retrospective way and trying to propensity match to get useful information out of it. And anyway, we saw quite a lot of that at the World Congress, and a lot of studies are coming out in the literature now have used propensity matching to try and make the most of all this data that is available.
Yeah, I mean, it is the technique of choice at the moment to try and draw the most accurate conclusion from doing these large retrospective data dredges, which, you know, they're not as valid as a prospective randomized controlled trial, but we collect all this data, and the US in particular are very good at storing it and going through it, and you can draw very valid and valuable conclusions. And I think, Mark, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the data in this JAMA paper, they do the linear regression modeling without the propensity score matching and then with the propensity score matching. And the propensity score matching actually appears to reduce the effect of the helicopter. So in other words, it makes the data less favorable for them.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So in fact, they're using it in an entirely valid way to sort of, and it actually detracts from their original point. And it detracts it to the point where in fact the numbers needed to treat are quite massive. So yeah, I'm sure, as exactly as you said, Frank, it is a good technique, and it just further validates regression modeling in these large data sets.
And just the one last thing, and the other reason I think this is attractive is that, and someone made this point at a conference recently, is that this is all looking at real-world data and real-world patients rather than study populations, which by necessity and due to design of studies and protocols are a very select group of patients.
Good. Well, I reckon we can do a UK version of this using our Trauma Audit Research Network database. So I'll give you two a call when I need the stats.
But have you seen the numbers, though? I mean, the thousands. I mean, it's obviously a big database, but I'm sure we don't transport anywhere nearly as big a proportion of patients by helicopter as they do in the States.
And Mark, if you were to use your own retrospective data that you've been collecting, how much sexier do you appear to the general public when you land in a helicopter as opposed to when you pull up in your souped-up Skoda?
Several orders of magnitude.
It doesn't matter how many numbers you need to treat. You just can't beat that.
It is diminished somewhat by the orangeness of the suit. I mean, if you could go blue, I think it would be even better.
Not all hem services wear orange. That's a controversial statement.
So we should probably move on to some more numbers. And Frank, you're going to tell us how low is too low for our preoperative anemia in our cardiac patients.
Am I?
Are you? Is that not what you're going to tell us?
Kind of. What I'd like to just share with you guys today was, and I'm afraid you'll have to bear with me over the next few podcasts because a lot of this will be fueled by what Rick and I managed to learn at the World Congress, and really just wanted to run through some of the points raised by a very good talk I went to about anemia and surgical outcomes. And we'll have the articles or links through to the articles on the website for you to look at. The article I'm talking about specifically today is one by Karkuti and colleagues, and they've published quite a lot on these topics. Fortunately, they are mostly cardiac surgery, but this one's called Advanced Targeted Transfusion in Anemic Cardiac Surgical Patients for Kidney Protection. And just as a way of an introduction, Karkuti, back in 2008, did the trial which showed that preoperative anemia increased the number of adverse outcomes in cardiac surgery. More recently than that, there's been the TRACS trial, which was transfusion requirements after cardiac surgery, and that looked at liberal versus restrictive transfusion policies, and that showed non-inferiority for 30-day all-cause mortality and major morbidity for patients who were essentially transfused less. And then the other article that they mentioned, which has some influence on this, is Colleen Koch et al. In the New England Journal. And that was all about duration of red cell storage. And they, again, did multivariate logistic regression analysis and propensity scoring and looked at the duration of storage of red blood cells on outcomes. And they determined from their study that if you got old blood that was older than 2 weeks, there was an increased risk of postoperative complications and decreased short- and long-term survival. And that obviously has... Well, the implication there was that the sort of storage lesion of red blood cells where you have decreased ATP, you lose the discoid shape of the cell, there's increased fragility and free hemoglobin, which is toxic. And what this study today is mentioning as well is perhaps the increased free iron and problems with iron storage can have an influence as well. And increased 2-3 DPG is the other aspect of storage lesion. And then just to backtrack to the TRAC study, which showed that a restrictive transfusion policy was not inferior to liberal, just to mention there that out of interest that they used 3-day old blood, which is probably really difficult to organize for any study. And I'm interested to get the data from where I'm working at the moment, but generally speaking, blood is obviously a lot older than that. In any case, this Karkuti study was just an unblinded pilot study, and obviously very difficult to blind transfusion, but they did look at cardiac surgical patients, and it was a small sample size, and as they say in their discussion, obviously it is just a pilot study, and they were really just looking to see whether transfusion 1 or 2 days before cardiac surgery had, in fact, they were really looking at outcomes of perioperative transfusion and anemia, but we're interested in looking at the influence on acute kidney injury as well. And you can't read too much into it. I just thought it was an interesting counterbalance to the whole lot of studies that have come out over recent years telling us all that blood transfusion is bad, and don't really have to Google much to find lots of those. And this is just interesting because it may be that transfusion of red blood cells prior to surgery can be protective, and specifically can be protective in terms of developing acute kidney injury. And as you may recall, preoperative anemia and perioperative transfusion has been shown to increase the rates of acute kidney injury after cardiac surgery. We know that there's renal dysfunction in up to 40% of patients undergoing cardiac surgery. They had 60 patients and managed to split them pretty evenly in those receiving transfusions and those not. And although, apart from there being less anemia in the group that received transfusions, which you can imagine, they also had much lower rates of acute kidney injury, and once again, a small sample size. And I think the interesting bit about that was that they postulate that perhaps that's firstly due to the fact that these patients never dropped down to a low hemoglobin or as low a hemoglobin as patients didn't receive preoperative transfusions, and that may well have implications on renal function during the perioperative period. And also, though, that it may be by giving blood 1 or 2 days beforehand that you minimize the effects of the storage lesion, which may influence the adverse outcomes that other studies have quoted. And there may also be an influence of the increased iron, amount of iron, and the effect that that has on renal toxicity and development of an acute kidney injury. So really, it's just to bear this in mind that perhaps transfusing blood isn't bad altogether, and that it may just be the timing of transfusion that we need to look at. And as they suggest in the paper, it's probably just it needs to be looked at in a proper study. And I think they worked out a sample size of about 1,000 patients that you would need to look at to see if there is any value to this.
The obvious thing is, if it's to do with the preoperative value, is there any work looking at giving these patients EPO?
There is, actually. In fact, there's, and I always assumed that you had to give EPO for some time, and I'll make up a number, but you know, maybe a week or two prior to surgery for it to kick in and have a benefit. But actually, there's an article, I'd have to look it up, but I think it's an anesthesia, and by an author called Yu, that's Y-O-O, I think. In any case, they were looking at high-dose erythropoietin given very short term, and I think this is, you know, either the day of surgery or quite very short term before surgery. And I just made some notes during the talk, so I don't know the details of this, but it was something like a 16% and 40% transfusion rate. So I think 16% in those who'd received EPO, as opposed to 40%. Which is probably about what average units do for blood transfusion, perioperative blood transfusion in cardiac surgery. So anyone who's interested can probably just Google that, you in anesthesia 2011, I think. And the problems with that, though, obviously are firstly the expense, and secondly the thrombotic risk, which I don't think has been clearly defined enough, just because we lack enough experience and large enough study populations at the moment.
Mark, we should do your question of the month. If you remember, guys, from 3 episodes ago when we first introduced this, and Arian Snook got it right, he did send in his name and address. His address. So I did, in fact, last week post him a free textbook. So that's now...
signed copy.
Precedent has been set. If you do enter and you are correct, we have got a number of textbooks to give away, and so we will definitely now do that. So, Mark, take it away.
Well, first of all, you need to package up and send one of these esteemed academic tomes to Nick, who correctly answered last week's question, which was in relation to London Hems carrying pre-hospital blood for the first time. I asked how much volume of oxygen could be carried by 4 units of blood. And he's very cleverly looked up from transfusionguidelines.org.uk a very large document which explains that a unit of blood will be 280 mils, give or take, and will contain at least 40 grams of hemoglobin. So from there, a couple of small calculations using the Huffner constant to calculate the amount of oxygen bound to hemoglobin, and a bit more that's dissolved in the fluid, he works out that 1 unit of blood could carry 54 and a bit mils of oxygen, so a total of 218, near enough mils altogether. Very geeky, very maths heavy, but well done, Nick. A book will be on its way to you if you send us your address.
Yeah, we will. We'll put all of Nick's working in the podcast notes if you want to check it yourself. But Mark, presumably you have and are satisfied. So yep. So Nick, if you just send us your address, we will get that sent to you.
Okay, so for this week's question, I thought I would do something similarly geeky and maths-heavy, and up the ante by making it a helicopter-based question, as that's what we're talking about today.
I think we do need to start making them harder as well, so that we don't run out of books.
It's all right, Rick's got a big stack of free copies.
If the same persons get the questions right, do they just get more copies, or are you going to get them a different book?
They have to wait for the next volume. Anyway, let me get this out. So, helicopter fuel is measured in weight rather than volume. So, if you take the combined weight of the gas cast crew here today and put that much fuel into the London Hems helicopter and fly due south, how far do you get before you run out of fuel and have to auto-rotate to the ground?
Hopefully.
Of course.
And how do they know the combined weight of the gas cast crew?
I don't know, have a guess. You've obviously got a high-pitched, girly voice, so probably very thin.
Not much so resonation.
Interesting.
That does give us a bit of leeway to tell people they got it wrong, though.
It does, and they don't have to take into account prevailing winds or anything like that. Let's not be carried away.
They just have to work out how much fuel the helicopter uses, how far it can get, and how much we weigh.
Yeah, or just any random guesses that are near enough. Let me share a secret with you, listeners. The previous winners have been the only entrants.
So any sensible response?
Are you more likely to win with a flattering estimate of our weights?
Yeah, exactly. This is going to open up whole issues with self-esteem. And
of course, Rick and I know this question is essentially unanswerable, and that Rick's one of the few people to beat the clown in a Las Vegas casino who was unable to guess Rick's weight even when looking at him.
So, Bex, before this turns into our longest podcast ever, why don't you tell us what you've been looking at for us this month?
So, my news item is an article that was recently published in Current Opinion in Anesthesiology. And it's a review of topical aspects of anaesthetic management that might potentially influence late post-operative outcomes for patients. What I like about the Current Opinion in Anesthesiology is that they give a fairly objective viewpoint on collections of studies about a particular aspect and then make fairly sensible recommendations. Now, this paper is particularly detailed, I think. It discusses surgical site infections, cancer recurrence, perioperative glycemic control, blood transfusions, perioperative beta blockade, the use of nitrous oxide, the development of chronic pain syndromes, the effect of anesthesia on the developing brain, and anesthesia and postoperative cognitive dysfunction. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but there are a couple of take-home messages and just some arguments that I wanted to highlight. Now, one of the plugs of this article is in favor of regional anesthesia, particularly looking at surgical site infections and cancer recurrence. They've structured the argument about surgical site infections around the Hagen-Poiseuille equation. And if you can remember that equation, it's the one that talks about flow in a cylindrical tube. And what they're mentioning is the blood flow to the tissues. Now, the point of regional anesthesia regarding oxygen delivery to the tissues would be that it reduces vasoconstriction and you'll get improved oxygen delivery. But there's also an emphasis in this article on normothermia, and we're all familiar with the NICE guidelines, nice and warm, as well as supplemental oxygen in the early post-operative delivery period, because this will have an effect on the pressure gradient, and enhance diffusion from the intravascular space into the tissues. Now, as far as the argument for regional anesthesia in cancer recurrence goes, it's based on the fact that we know that surgery and anesthesia per se depress cell-mediated immunity. But in animal models, they've also found that both pain and opiates facilitate cancer spread. So what they're saying is if you use regional anesthesia, you'd have less general anesthesia and hopefully less opioid use, and you'd have less cancer recurrence, particularly where people have attempted curative surgery, but there may still be residual micrometastases, which then can result in residual disease if the sort of balance in the body loses out against the tumor cells. Now, interestingly, they mention that tramadol is unlike other opioids, and that can actually enhance natural killer cell activity. As far as the non-steroidals go, a single perioperative dose of ketorolac may reduce the actual activity of tumor cells. So they're suggesting that a really well-balanced anesthetic involving regional anesthesia, single dose of a non-steroidal, particularly ketorolac, and the use of tramadol may be your best option to try and reduce cancer recurrence in these patients. Then they talk about blood transfusions, and we know that transfused blood has immunomodulatory effects, and that if we use blood, especially old blood, you have increase in long-term mortality rates. So there's just a discussion about how you can reduce blood transfusions. I'm sure EPO will rear its head again as a method of ensuring that there's adequate pre-op hemoglobin levels, avoiding hypothermia intraoperatively in order to optimize the patient's coagulation ability, and the use of cell salvage or antifibrinolytics where you're able to, or where there's no contraindications. And then they sort of discuss some things which are still controversial, like perioperative glycemic control, perioperative beta blockade, and the use of nitrous oxide, which there are no clear answers at the moment, but it's nice just to review the studies that have been done on these subjects. For the glycemic control, they know that a blood sugar of greater than 11 intraoperatively is definitely bad, but that they recommend that you should treat that, but not necessarily aim for tight glycemic control, being a blood sugar of 4.5 to 6. And that if you are going to treat hypoglycemia, you should use an infusion of insulin rather than boluses, which is in contradiction to some recent studies that have come out which recommended giving intraoperative boluses of intravenous insulin. And then as far as perioperative beta blockers go, they review the POISE trial. And in that trial, I'm sure you can remember, they gave patients metoprolol a couple of hours before surgery and then continued the metoprolol for 30 days afterwards to see what effect the perioperative beta blockade had on myocardial infarction. And what they found was that there was less incidence of myocardial infarction in these patients, but there was a greater incidence of death and strokes. Now, we're still awaiting the one-year follow-up, so there's no answer to that argument, as well as the answer to whether we should use nitrous oxide or not. Now, that trial that they talk about there is the Enigma trial, where 2,000 patients which were having non-cardiac surgery, which lasted longer than 2 hours, were randomized to either receive nitrous oxide or not. And there was an increased 30-day mortality rate and an increased incidence of myocardial infarction in the nitrous oxide group. But they were not sure if that was attributable to the nitrous oxide or whether it was the difference in the inspired oxygen fraction. So they're having the Enigma 2 trial, which is currently underway, and that will hopefully give a bit more clarification on that. So I don't think there's anything specifically new in this article, but it is just a nice discussion of the studies that have led to the current thinking. And I think it's nice just to realize that we may have some sort of impact on patient outcome, as opposed to them just waking up without frank awareness and a lot of pain. So,
well, thank you, Bex. That was. It's always good to know that we can be extending our reach of the patient's care into things that are a bit more long term.
I think that's why I find this article useful. It's a good review of what's already been done. Although in itself, I didn't think contained any new work or meta analysis or anything. It's just a nicely done summary of what we already know.
Yeah, but you know, it's fine because I'm not really a statistics girl.
Absolutely, saves. I mean, they've done all the hard reading here. And,
exactly.
Made our life easier.
That's exactly what you want. The other question I had was nitrous oxide. Is anyone aware of a reason to give it?
Consultant greater than 50? I don't know.
Ouch.
Yeah, I think that's unfair. I do still use nitrous sometimes for its analgesic effect.
But Frank, you are actually quite old.
I am rapidly approaching my 50s.
Just wondered if there was any study that anyone was aware of that had had an outcome measure where nitrous had been beneficial over an alternative, because I can't think of one.
No, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, and I think, you know, when they look at the Enigma results and the long-term outcomes, it's probably going to look as if we shouldn't be using it. I'm also gratified to see, Bex, that the paper does make mention of some of our past podcast episodes on anesthesia and the developing brain.
Excellent. Right. There's been quite a good study coming out, isn't there, about repeated exposure to anesthetics, and so whether it's like a cumulative dosage effect that is the problem as opposed to isolated incidences. But I suppose you'll have to just review that when it comes out.
Possibly. We could do a quick N equals 4 straw poll here. How many anesthetics has everyone had? I've had one.
Yeah. I've had one.
I've had one, but it was a good one, and we went through a lot of drugs, so I might count as more than one.
Was it a recreational one?
No, it was given to me by a friend and colleague, so we decided we'd...
It's sounding more and more dodgy.
Yeah, for an unnecessary intervention. So we just felt that we should... there was great benefit in experiencing the results of the various drugs we used. So I had a reasonable dose of alfentanil and then subclinical dose of propofol and a bit of midazolam, I think, and then eventually it was enough playtime and they got me off to sleep.
Oh, wow. I've had three, but they were all gas inductions as a kid, which I presume would be halothane.
So you've had three gas inductions at the most damaging developmental time of your life.
Which is why I never discuss the statistics in the papers.
Well, our study of four has got some very clear results.
Well, I think we've certainly detected a signal.
I think we should propensity match ourselves.
Let's quickly finish up with a statistical-based biology or bunkum.
Yay!
Shall I just resign gracefully now?
No. You'll like this. This is an everyone can play.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you three statistics, one of which is bunkum. So quite simple. So number one, 50% of the world's population is under the age of 30. Number two, bearing in mind that it's still banned in China, which is the world's largest country, if Facebook was a country, it would be the world's fifth largest. And number three, Lady Gaga has more Twitter followers than the entire population of Australia. So those are your three statistics, two of which are roughly true, and one of which is bogus. So, Frank, do you want to have first crack at this one?
I am a bit stumped. I'm going to go for Lady Gaga.
You don't think Lady Gaga can be more popular than the entirety of Australia?
I suppose Australia's perhaps not that populous.
We're not counting sheep, are we? Just people.
I think it is people. Or sheep with Twitter accounts.
Yeah, it's people and sheep with Twitter accounts.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Lady Gaga. I'll stick with that.
Lady Gaga. Okay, Rebecca.
Which one was the second one again? Just tell me which one was the second one, because I think that's bunkum.
If Facebook was a country, it would be the world's fifth largest.
Oh, yeah, bunkum. I'm sure it's bigger than that.
Sure it's bigger than that. Okay, fair enough. And Mark?
I think the first one is bunkum. I think 50% of the population are not under 30. I think they're mostly old farts.
Mostly old farts. Interesting. So I think that's the first time we've ever had a full spread.
Yeah.
Full spread meaning one person is definitely right.
Probably me.
So, number one, Mark. I'm afraid for all of us, that is in fact true. We are all older than 50% of the world's population. The average age of the world in 2011 was 32. No, sorry, it wasn't. It was under 30. It was 29.
Wait, name yourselves. What do you mean the average age? The question you asked was surely the median age.
No, it would have been the average age. 50% of the world's population is... No, you're right. It would have been the mode.
No.
No, it would have been the median.
That's what I said.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, Mark. Your statistics, your descriptive statistics are right, but you are wrong in biology and bunkum. Because I did actually go and look all of these up, and 50% of the world's population is indeed under 30. So suck it. Number three is also Frank. You were hovering there, but that is in fact true. As of today, Lady Gaga has over 23 million followers. It's 23,270,000. She is the most popular person on Twitter. But the entire population of Australia, according to Wikipedia, is only 22 million.
Oh, but that's clearly 2010 data.
No, I think it was 2011 data. And based on the number of new Australians born every day and the number of people who decide they're going to follow Lady Gaga, I'm sure she's probably
that
still
is
more popular.
Very impressive, yeah. Maybe we should be asking her to retweet us.
Anyway, and so, Rebecca, that does mean that you are, in fact, correct. And you're also correct for all the right reasons. Because
I'm a genius.
China has banned Facebook since 2004. China also, incidentally, bans gascast.co.uk.
Does it?
Yes, because as of November 2011, China has taken the decision to ban all WordPress sites. So anything with WordPress in your HTML code gets blocked by the Great Firewall. So both us and Facebook are banned. And they're the world's largest country, but despite that, if Facebook was a country, it would be the world's third largest. And it's bigger,
I think.
Yeah, I think it would be China number one, India number two, and then Facebook. It's bigger than the US, which I thought was quite
amazing.
Of
a quick poll, how many of us are on Facebook? Is everyone on Facebook?
We're all on Facebook.
Except for me. I'm not.
Are you not?
I'm too cool for Facebook. Yeah, totally.
You are too cool for Facebook. That's excellent.
Bex, let's face it. I think you just struggle with the technology too much to be on Facebook.
I couldn't quite work out the security settings, so I thought I'd just remove myself.
Or in fact, so you were on Facebook and you think you've removed yourself, but you're not sure.
That's a very good point. When I get back to the UK, one of you will help tell me.
And in fact, that begs the question, what was on your Facebook that you were worried about that you couldn't get the security settings right?
I'm definitely not answering that.
And while we speculate as to what Rebecca has on her Facebook account, we'll end this episode. Just a quick reminder about the GAT annual scientific meeting in June. It's sure to be a great event. We're very much looking forward to going, and we'll be recording some sort of special episode whilst we're in Glasgow. Hope to see you there, and thanks for listening.